Welcome to Face Connecticut, an in-depth look at today's issues.
Good morning and welcome to another edition of Face Connecticut on WTIC, News Talk 1080, 96.5 TIC FM, and Light 100.5 WRCH. Aaron Kupek with you this Sunday morning, and we are pleased to be joined by Dr. Tom Babor. He is an addiction researcher and professor in the UConn School of Medicine's Department of Public Health Sciences. Good morning to you, sir.
Good morning.
We are here to talk about gambling. Of course, the deal announced recently between the Lamont administration and the state's two federally recognized casino-owning tribes is working its way through the General Assembly, expected to pave the way for electronic gaming, so on your smartphone and computer, and also sports betting. Dr. Babor, let's start first with your reaction to this deal announced by the entities involved. It's the result of years of negotiations between the tribes and the state, and it runs 10 years and calls for new taxes on both sports betting and online gaming.
Well, you know, the devil's in the details, and this agreement is not final as I understand it, and it's likely or it's necessary to send it to the state legislature, which we'll have to look at it closely. But the general idea of increasing the availability of sports betting, making that legal, and internet gambling needs to be looked at in the context of a trend, which is very disturbing, of the increase of gambling opportunities in general. And when that happens in a state or a country, there tends to be an increase not only in the amount of money wagered, but also in the proportion of people who experience serious problems. So the real risk here is that it's going to contribute to a trend of liberalization and increased availability of gambling, which will increase the amount of gambling problems that are experienced in the state of Connecticut.
Some of the proponents have argued for years now that there's already been sports betting taking place in Connecticut. It's just been illegal, and this allows the government to sanction it and bring it into the light where it can be regulated. How do you respond to that?
Well, it depends on whether the regulation is meaningful and impactful. And secondly, that assumption may not be entirely correct. When internet gambling, for example, was made legal in countries like France, there was an increase in the overall amount of gambling and gambling problems in the country. So over the course of a couple of years after 2010, they monitored problem gambling and found not only was more money spent, but more people developed problem gambling or problems with their gambling.
Now, you, along with an international group of researchers, actually wrote a book on gambling policy and the impact of problem gambling. What were some of your other conclusions?
Well, the group that I worked with came from about seven or eight different countries, people who had spent their careers as social scientists, psychiatrists, and other people working on gambling issues. And what we did was reviewed the world literature on what is known about the problems connected with gambling and how to regulate it. And one of the first conclusions we drew from our global review of the scientific evidence is that there has been a dramatic expansion throughout the world in gambling opportunities since the 1980s. And over this period, there have been a liberalization of traditional restrictions and a change in moral attitudes. In the past, it was considered sinful and people frowned upon gambling. Those attitudes have changed dramatically. So we've got an increase in opportunities, liberalization of controls, and we've got more people developing gambling problems. More people participating in gambling activities, particularly in the high-income countries, but also in Asia. What we've also found is that there's been a proliferation of much more harmful types of gambling opportunities or games, from the transition from slot machines to electronic gaming machines to instant lotteries and things like that. So we're entering a period of a perfect storm where more and more opportunities to engage in more and more addictive types of gambling opportunities is creating what may be a serious burden on the health of the population.
We've seen this evolution of gambling right here in Connecticut. You start with the lottery, and then you go to greyhound racing and high lie in the 80s, and then the opening of the casinos in the early 90s. What do you think is behind that? Is it social evolution? What else is at play here?
Well, you know, we've seen this occurring with drugs and alcohol, you know, legalization of medical cannabis, and now the consideration of recreational use. So, you know, a lot of it is driven in part by just changing attitudes, but it is also the inability of politicians to raise taxes. And there's a belief that you can raise revenues for worthy causes by taxing sinful behavior, which in the past, sin taxes have been levied on alcohol and tobacco. And in some cases, when those taxes are levied, they have had an impact in reducing consumption in the case of cigarettes. But we've got all these trends coming together. And the main thing is that when opportunities for gambling are increasing, we're likely to experience problem. And now the challenge is to weigh the benefits versus the cost to society.
And it's a little different with gambling compared to alcohol or cigarettes, because those were items that were already on the market, and politicians decide to increase taxes on them to bring in more revenue. But in the case of something like sports betting in Connecticut, that's not legal. It's not as if you're just raising a tax on something that already exists.
Right. And here the argument is it would raise revenues, and it's already being done. But as I mentioned, the little amount of research that is available on what happens when you introduce sports betting and internet gambling legally is that it just increases the demand for gambling in general. So it's not going to necessarily be neutral in terms of just capturing the people who are already doing it. More people may be introduced to gambling. And the real risk here is young people.
Expand on that.
Well, for example, with internet gambling, what we know, again, from not a whole lot of research, because all of this stuff is new, and it takes, you know, 4 or 5 years for people who study these kinds of things to become, to be able to understand what their impact is. But with internet gambling, what we do know from some countries is that it attracts more highly educated people who are computer literate, obviously smartphones and things like that. So the damage may be less, because we know from looking at gambling in general that it impacts the poor and the vulnerable the most. But in A lot of people who don't have these vulnerabilities are initially attracted to something like an innovation like sports betting or internet gambling. But at the same time, kids get into that because they're very computer literate. And what you're starting to see, at least in the illegal market for gaming and betting on sports, is that marketing by illegal providers and gaming operators who are blurring the lines between gambling and gaming, the marketing is targeting young people. And this is, once you get people introduced, it is a lucrative source of profit. So loot boxes in built into games don't differ too much from gambling in that kids are being introduced to this idea of the excitement of winning something for nothing when a reward is provided and a credit is given to buy some other virtual prize. And so young people are being targeted through the internet, and we've seen this happening with alcohol and tobacco and music and other things. Once they get your profile, they can target you with all kinds of messages, and we all get this in our activities on the internet. And that kind of thing is difficult to control.
Are different forms of gambling more addictive than others?
Yeah, definitely. So as a general rule of thumb, the electronic gambling machines, particularly the ones with all the bells and whistles and frequent payouts that are very small, with a lot of other kinds of psychological tricks to keep people engaged in the game itself for a long period of time, they tend to be the ones associated most with pathological gambling. The ones that seem to be associated least, but still can be problematic, are lotteries and games like bingo and things like that, where there are small payouts and people don't necessarily receive encouragement to play the game for a long period of time.
You are listening to Face Connecticut. We are talking to Tom Babor. He is an addiction researcher and professor in the UConn School of Medicine's Department of Public Health Sciences. One of the arguments for sports betting and online gaming is that, well, other states are doing it, so Connecticut has to get on board or it's going to miss out. Is it too early to know the effects in other states, in other jurisdictions where this is already legal?
It is definitively, because we just don't have enough research that's done, because this is a new phenomenon. But we know that when you increase the opportunities for people to gamble, increase its convenience, and provide access to high-risk and potentially addictive games, that you will increase the amount of money that people lose, and you will provide a situation where pathological gambling can develop over a period of time, which is a convergence of psychiatric symptoms and behaviors which make it difficult for people to control their behavior, in this case, gambling behavior.
We talked recently with the chairman of the Mashantucket Pequot tribe, and he said that electronic gaming is safer for people who might develop an addiction because the operators of the games know how to spot it based on, you know, the activity online of individual people. How would you respond to that?
Well, there are some things that have been adopted by the gambling industry to try to minimize these catastrophic trends or catastrophic impacts on individuals when they become addicted and lose their livelihood and ruin their families and so forth. So there can be mechanisms put into place in casino gambling types of organizations where people can be monitored, their access to credit can be limited, they can be issued warnings. And so we do have some examples through the research that has been conducted that show that certain types of interventions and regulations can limit the damage. But the one thing to remember is that once somebody starts spiraling out of control, it's tough to put the toothpaste back in the tube. Once somebody develops a gambling addiction, once they lose all of their life savings and borrow money from friends or steal it from employers, they've ruined their lives and affected, on average, the lives of five or six other people around them. And when that happens, it's almost too late to take advantage of some of these restrictions, because they don't necessarily prevent things. They capture somebody when they're spiraling out of control.
Typically, when a new form of gaming or gambling is approved, there are provisions attached for providing help to people who have an addiction. When you hear the ads about, you know, gambling helplines and things like that, how effective are those? How many people recognize for themselves that they might have a problem and call those lines? Or is it something where the gambling provider is going to intervene instead?
Yeah, there's a little bit of research on self-assessment opportunities. People can take a screening test on pathological gambling and stuff like that. But that doesn't have much of an impact. When the casinos and the state offer opportunities for people to access diagnostic services and treatment, and helplines in particular, they do help a significant number of people. But again, it's almost too late at that point when somebody is in bad enough shape to feel like they have to get help. And the help is often inadequate because there's not enough funding devoted to treatment to keep up with the need, if not the demand.
As lawmakers weigh gaming expansion in Connecticut, expanding into iGaming and sports betting, do you feel that concerns about problem gambling have been an appropriate part of the conversation in Connecticut?
I don't think there has been enough consideration. And what we did in the book, Setting Limits, was to look at what is known about the epidemiology of gambling problems. And it's not only the people who are affected, the ones who are called problem gamblers, the ones who are called pathological gamblers, which is much more serious, and it's the people around them. So rarely are families and children taken into account when states try to raise revenues by expanding gambling opportunities.
I want to go back to the issue of taxation. There was a debate a couple of years back in Connecticut about expanding the sales tax to cover more items, specifically at the grocery store, and that was shelved because it was criticized as a regressive tax. Would you say gambling, when there's tax applied, is that more regressive or less regressive than, say, a sales tax on groceries?
Yeah, one of the main conclusions from our review of research conducted in many different countries around the world is that gambling is, particularly legal gambling, is a way of taxing the poor. The burden falls disproportionately on people of low income, people who are vulnerable psychologically and have marginal incomes, which they can't afford to lose. And so most of the revenue that is being raised is coming from people who can least afford it. So in that respect, it is regressive.
Have you seen that play out with the forms of gambling that have been legalized over the years in Connecticut?
Very little research has been done on Connecticut itself. In general, what we know from studies in the U.S. and in other countries is that problem gamblers somewhere around, 40 or 50% of them tend to be of lower income and also have other issues with their lives, that those people contribute a significant proportion to gambling expenditures, some countries up to 40 or 50%. So what we're doing is taking income from those least capable or least able to afford it, who have a variety of problems which eventually need to be dealt with: health problems, psychiatric problems, substance abuse, suicide, unemployment. We are encouraging them to spend more of their income on activities which in the long run are not doing anybody any good.
In our final minute, if someone hears this and recognizes that they have a problem, what's the best way to reach out for help?
Well, helplines are definitely encouraged, who can provide a quick assessment of the person's problems and refer them to appropriate treatment, some of which are very effective.
He is Dr. Tom Babor, an addiction researcher and professor in the UConn School of Medicine's Department of Public Health Sciences. Thanks so much for joining us this morning.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to Face Connecticut. I'm Aaron Kupek. Enjoy the balance of your weekend.
Face Connecticut is a production of the News and Public Affairs Department of WTIC Radio.